Welcome to the Second Reading Podcast from the University of Texas at Austin.
The Republicans were in the Democratic Party because there was only one party.
So I tell people on a regular basis, there is still a land of opportunity in America. It's called Texas.
The problem is these departures from the Constitution, they have become the norm.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
And welcome back to the Second Reading Podcast. I'm Jim Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin. Glad to be joined today after our summer hiatus, more or less, by Texas Politics Project Research Director Josh Blank. How was your summer hiatus?
It was, you know, listen, I got kids. Y'all know, you've heard it. Like, we got to hit the beach, that kind of thing. So the South Padre thing, all that. But I've been hearing from our dozens of fans, many dozens, maybe, well, not many dozens, but
well,
some,
that guy.
Well, he might be part of a dozen, you know, and we're glad to be back. It has felt weird. I mean, it's strange. I mean, some of it is like each week was like, well, we, you know, it's been a weird summer in a sense, I think,
yeah,
like
sure.
News-wise.
Well, you've not taught during the summer before.
I've never taught during the summer before. So there is that. But I was even going to say news-wise, and I think it's always kind of like this. I mean, you mentioned this in a podcast before we left, but like the summer is the time for trial balloons.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of like, we talked about this before, there's a lot of shiny objects that kind of are floating around sometimes. And sometimes it's a polling result. Sometimes it's a press release. Sometimes, you know, somebody announces whatever and you're like, oh, it's an interim charge or some hearings. But it's all kind of, but it's random. It feels very like mixed in a way that it's hard. There's a lot we could talk about on any given week, but there wasn't necessarily like a central
Yeah. Sometimes
story.
You feel like you're taking somebody's bait.
Yeah.
You know,
well, yeah.
By elevating something. But I think this summer, you know, another dimension, and this kind of is a good transition to what we want to talk about. I mean, I think, but one of the things that has made this summer even trickier in that response is that because the election environment is more competitive,
yeah,
there are more of those trial balloons
yes.
that are potentially more meaningful.
Yes.
You know, just to call it what it is. Particularly from the Republican leadership mm-hmm. and specifically from Governor Abbott.
That's right. Yeah, no, I think that's a really good point. And we're going to talk a lot about, you know, all the polling. I kind of say like all the polling that's going
right.
on. But that's sort of part of what's interesting right now is because there's so much attention on the state. You know, I mean, like this is where that's
and sort of, because it's closer.
Well, that's
yeah,
why.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, that's what I say. I mean, I was about to think about, you know, the first mention of the word endogenous after the break, but it's like it's related to the competitiveness, and that competitiveness is producing just more noise out there that we're seeing. And so it can feel a little bit trickier
again,
to kind of
both more noise and more activity.
Yeah. Well, more, well, I'll say,
you know, so the signal to noise ratio is the question.
Yeah, right? Exactly. I was going to say there's a signal in the noise, but it's noisy right now.
Yeah.
All right.
So, you know, so which sets us up. So the agenda today really is that having been out 3-4 weeks, is to check back in on the 2026 election in Texas is at least the opening salvo, and it connects with a lot of other things going on and they to the election. But particularly, I think we'll focus on the top two statewide races in Texas, race for the U.S. Senate, race for governor. And we'll wind up maybe bringing in some of the other races or some of the other polling on here. You know, we're expecting another poll. We were actually kind of expecting it today, but the release apparently got delayed from the Bush School at Texas A&M, the second Pulse poll,
I think they're calling it, which is
a collaboration between the Bush School at A&M, Reconnaissance Market Research, and the Siena Research Institute in New York. That's now apparently coming tomorrow.
Yeah.
So we'll be watching for that. But that poll, and on top of about three polls that we've seen in about the last month and a half, if you go back to the New York Times Siena poll.
Yeah.
Have pretty unambiguously showed an increasingly tightening Senate race between Ken Paxton and James Tallarico. And that's just fueling this dynamic you're talking about where there's a lot more national mm-hmm. attention on that race. You know, so we've had three successful polls in that period showing Tallarico with a slight lead.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the most recent two polls, which I just mentioned, which are both conducted in late July, one by Fox News and one by TSU and YouGov, and they showed Tallarico up, you know, 3 and up 2 respectively, which we should note is within the margin of error.
Right.
That's why we say it's a tight race. We can't say, you know, Tallarico's in the lead, or, I mean, right now it's just really, really tight. And it's not, and I'll just say it's not, and what's notable here, I think, relative to past races maybe, and kind of where we are at this point in time, it's notable that like the share of like don't knows and unsures is very low.
Yeah.
In a lot of these polls, even when they provide people with that option. And so, you know, that's not like a, I mean, I think people made a pretty big deal about this with the Fox News poll. I mean, Tallarico pulled above 50%. He was at 51%, which, I mean, right, to be honest, I don't, you don't see a lot of Democrats polling above 51% at any point.
Well,
in
I think
the
we
cycle,
have to put an asterisk on it, because I, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe the Fox poll did not have the Libertarian candidate in there.
They did not.
And I think the Texas Southern did.
It did. That's correct.
So that, you know, that basically, I think, close to accounts, you know, not entirely.
Right.
But close to accounts for that, what nudged Tallarico over that,
right,
you know, sort of seemingly or allegedly magical 50% mark.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, it's obviously it's magical in an election,
but
it's not, you know, I mean, in polling, and this, we'll get to this point in polling over the summer.
Yeah, this is,
you know, it's, you know, I mean, it's not nothing, but it.
No, but I mean, I think one of the things that, you know, I've been thinking about a lot is, you know, we sort of have a pretty good sense of the, you know, that sort of the, I'll say like the narrative trajectory of the polling in the state over the course of an election cycle, having seen a bunch of it. And, you know, we can look back at our own data and kind of see, you know, well, okay, this is what it looked like in June. What did it look like in August? What did it look like in October? And I mean, and the thing that to start with is, you know, it doesn't always look, I mean, I'll say it rarely looks the same.
Right.
That's the first thing. And I'm not saying that, you know, we should expect, you know, the bottom to fall out from Tallarico, or for Ken Paxton to just come, you know, charging in and, you know,
or for Tallarico to just put him away.
Yeah,
necessarily.
No. But I think
all of those things could happen, but we have no idea.
Right. And the point is just to say that, you know, generally speaking, there's different ways we could put this, but, you know, a lot of, you know, one is to say, hey, you know, election polls conducted in the summer before the election are not terribly predictive of the outcome. You know, you got to get a lot closer. And we talk about this all the time. That's not because polling is inherently inaccurate. It's because, you know, there's a lot of electioneering to be done. You know, Abbott's going to spend $100 million. Tallarico is going to spend $100 million.
Yeah, so we're, you know,
we're just getting started, and we see a lot of changes. And so that's just to say.
And we'll go over this again and again before the election. I mean, the notion of us, you know, we're making estimates of a moving target.
Right, exactly. Right?
And the target's kind of fuzzy in terms of what the electorate's
going to be. And the campaigns are acting strategically to make changes to those groups' preferences, right? And that's the thing, is that's the other piece of this, is that, you know, I think right now the thing that's sort of, I wouldn't say taken aback is too strong, but as someone who watches a lot of polling, I think the sort of really strong statements that people have made, by which I mean, you know, commentators, some reporters, you know, whatever, but some very strong statements about the nature of the electorate here and there, and about, you know, what's going on. And I just, you know, I'm just sort of like, you know, let's be cautious.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of time here.
Well, let's dig into that in terms, because a lot of that revolves around reading of subgroup preferences that are being pulled out of these polls. Again, the methodological point we should make at the outset, these subgroups are always going to have larger margins of errors than the overall sample.
Right.
In some cases, much larger.
Right.
You know, particularly when we're talking about the ethnic groups, and particularly Black voters to a lesser extent, but still significantly Latino voters. Let's start with independents real quick, but also a very large margin of error, because certainly in our poll, where the independents fluctuate between about 9 and 11 or 12 at the top end of the sample. And again, the usual explanation, these are true independents. We fold leaners into
the
partisans.
Yeah.
And, you know, we talked about that a bunch. We won't divert into that. But it is, you know, we were talking about this before we started recording. That is one of the big differences this cycle and the last several cycles, in that independents at this point are leaning pretty significantly and fairly consistently towards Tallarico.
Yeah, I mean, in 2018, when we were watching this, you know, it was really notable when independents shifted in favor of O'Rourke. And it was notable because really none of the polling that we had done, you know, in the years prior, did we see in trial ballots independents expressing a marked preference for the Democratic candidate really under any circumstances. So this was notable. And at the end of that race, when we sort of, you know, do the math, you know, check the receipts and say, okay, well, how did O'Rourke, you know, get so close to Cruz? One of the big factors in that race was the breaking of independents as well. Well, what did it look like in our October 2018 polling? Beto had a 12-point advantage among independents. And I'm going to use margins here from a suggestion from a friend. You know, when we jump ahead to the all-red race in 2024, interestingly, you know, he was plus 12 with independents also, and the numbers were pretty close, which shows, I mean, to me, we were in a state before where independents decidedly leaned towards the Republican candidates. And we're starting to see, I think, in more recent races, a slight, if not a, just a toss-up group, in some cases, a lean towards Democrats. So again, plus 12 Beto, plus 12 all-red at the end of those cycles. If you look at these numbers for Tallarico right now, the New York Times Siena poll in June, he was plus 27. The Fox News poll just at the end of last month, he was plus 29. And in that TSU YouGov poll, he was plus 40.
Yeah.
Now, I will say, and we know this all the time, they bounce around. I mean, independents are less, you know, they're less tied to sort of the partisan rhetoric. But even with large margins of sampling error, small sample sizes, 12 and 40 are different. Like these are different, these are different estimates we're talking about. And also because we can look at multiple polls showing pretty similar estimates, you know, the advantage that he's demonstrating among independents is something that, you know, Republicans have expressed concern about, and they rightfully so.
Yeah. Well, and I think the other thing that's lurking here, and this is a little bit more of a general point as we go into this that maybe should have mentioned, you know, it's a little unclear to me. The New York Times Siena poll, the Texas Southern poll are both using likely voter screens, and I don't remember what the likely voter screens are. Our poll, the Fox News poll, was still in the RV poll.
Yeah.
And that's also probably inflecting this a little, you know, a little bit.
I mean, interestingly,
there's not a clear pattern, but it matters just as disclosure.
It's definitely worth addressing. I mean, I will say it is notable that looking across these three recent polls with LV and RV samples, like they're not that different.
Yeah.
You know, the underlying tendencies are looking pretty clear. And I think that also, there's a reason I think for that, which is, especially in this race, the shared that don't have an opinion right now is so low.
Right.
That those are a lot of the people that you might sweep out. But it seems to me that this is becoming a high knowledge race. Like people are developing attitudes that, you know, you're going to have to move them off of in a way. And so we're seeing it even as we do cycle into the more focused groups, because the differences are not as big as we normally expect.
I think something we have to go back and check, looking at the differences, looking at the numbers here among independents, and we could have checked this before the podcast, but I'm just noticing now, is that I think the dramatically lower shares of undecideds in the independent polls compared to our June poll. Now, that could be a matter of timing, but I wonder if that's a matter of, you know, how leaners are being classified in those polls. I just don't remember how.
Yeah. I had a mental note about this morning. I think this is too much for the podcast listeners to deal with. But I would say, I think part of it is that, you know, if you go back not too long ago, we still didn't have a decided Senate candidate.
Right. Right.
All right.
So there is, you know, something going on with the sampling and independence.
Yeah.
And, you know,
well, but this also speaks to something that I think we should hammer one more time, which is it's also the summer.
Yeah.
And I think one of the, you know, and like we'll come back to this again and again, but the electorate does not exist yet. There's going to be a lot of money spent. There's going to be a lot of attention, time to mobilization, turnout, blah, 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 blah. Mm-hmm.
Mobilization and even counter, you know, demobilization.
Yeah, mobilization, demobilization, countermobilization. Yeah, yeah. There's a lot of factors at play here that are going to have to play out over the course of the next, you know, few months. And that is all going to play into, you know, what that ultimate actual pool of voters looks like. And that's always a bit of a guess this far out.
Okay, so let's look at another group that speaks to the Republican race mainly and many of the issues in the ether that have really, I guess it's the same metaphor, taking up a lot of oxygen during the summer, and that's rural voters.
Yeah.
Right, who we expect to lean, obviously, very heavily towards Republicans. Mm-hmm. They are still leaning very heavily towards Republicans, and it's an interesting kind of, you know, there's an interesting discussion to be had about what we're seeing in the polling in the election races.
Mm-hmm.
Or the election trial ballots, and what we're seeing on these issues that are riling up rural voters.
Yeah.
In that, you know, rural voters are not down with data centers.
Yeah.
Skeptical of AI.
Yeah.
Seemingly sticking, though, with some attrition to Republican candidates.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there is a little bit of a mismatch between the tenor of the public discussion about this.
Yeah.
In, well, I shouldn't even say the public discussion, the tenor of the press coverage of this, and what we're seeing in a more narrowly in the realm of election polling.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, look, you know, when we look at the vote margins in the rural counties in Texas, which are most of the counties in Texas, even if it's only like 20% of the population, we tend to see the Republican candidates at the top of the ticket winning by somewhere, you know, somewhere in the early 70 to 75% of the vote, right? And in truth, when we look back at 2018, we look at our polling, we did see Ted Cruz polling 70% of the rural vote. O'Rourke was 26. It was pretty close. But look, you know, a lot has happened politically since then. And I think, you know, the rural part of the state is getting a little bit more competitive, but marginally so. And when we look at the margins, you know, Cruz in October 2024 polling of our own, he was plus 28 in the rural and people among people who identified where they lived as a rural part of the state. You know, right now, Paxton in the Fox News poll was plus 26.
Right.
You know, the New York Times Siena poll, and they, you know, their definitions of things are interesting. I'm going to leave that aside. You know, he's plus 31. So, but I'd say those are two pretty consistent estimates, you know, of a pretty, you know, consistent level of support, but it's lower. So, as again, where Cruz was getting 70% in that 2018 race, you know, we're seeing him polling closer to 60% in the 2024 race. And then if we look at, you know, right now, Paxton's in a similar space, about 60, 62, 63%. And this is one of those things that's really interesting for Democrats. You know, I don't think Ken Paxton has a rural problem. I would just say that right now. But the continued effort by Democrats to run candidates in those areas may be starting to reap some benefit. And it's not going to be because those candidates are going to win.
It's in the size of the margin.
It's not in the size of the margin. It's not 20. If you can take turn 22 or 26% into 31, 35, 36%, that accrues in terms of chipping away at the margin that Democrats want to chip away at. But at this point, this is not a problem for Republicans. And if anything, I just want to add one more thing.
Yeah.
This is the one area where in 2018, we did see that when it, you know, when push comes to shove,
yeah,
Republicans are good at mobilizing rural voters if they have to.
It's part of the conventional wisdom that I think has been reasonably demonstrated that part of that last minute push in the final weekend between Election Day and the end of early voting did happen in these rural areas in terms of driving up more turnout. And
right.
So it's part of the accepted wisdom that that was part of what saved Ted Cruz in 2018.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think by way of transition to talking about partisanship, and I want to come back to some other aspect of this, but
yeah,
this is a good way to do this, I think, is I would have probably modified that. Ken Paxton does not have a rural problem distinct from his overall Republican problem right now.
Right. It's not
and again, to the extent that that's a problem, but let's talk about the – so what are Paxton's numbers looking like among Republicans compared both previous races and, but more especially compared to Tallarico with Democrats, because Tallarico has definitely sewn up Democrats, to, at least in the polling, to a higher extent than Paxton has sewn up Republicans.
Yeah, I mean,
not by some massive margin, but by a noticeable amount. I mean,
well, yeah, I mean, we're sitting here talking about
10 points, 10,
12.
Yeah,
no, I mean, we're sitting here talking about these tiny margins, and I don't want to come in here and then say, well, this tiny margin doesn't matter. But I mean, I sort of feel a little bit that way about this. I think the support that Ken Paxton is expected or likely to receive among Republicans is not, you know, the primary level of concern here at this point. I mean, what's notable in some ways is how overwhelmingly Tallarico has sewed up Democrats. I mean, that's what actually stands out. I mean, if we look back, you know, at those two cycles in 2018 and in 2024, you know, the most O'Rourke ever got was to 94% of Democrats. That was on the eve of the 2018 election. A New York Times Siena had Tallarico with 94% of Democrats back at the beginning of June. Fox had him at 98% of Democrats.
You know, TSU, about a month later.
Yeah, TSU, YouGov him at 97% of Democrats. And I gotta say, like, real quick, as a pollster, 97, 98% of anything is like insanely high.
Does it make you suspicious at all? I mean, do you have concerns? I mean, I would say when I look at 98 or 97 of anything, I do kind of go, well, I wonder.
Yeah, I mean,
it makes sense, but.
Yeah, I mean, a little bit. You know, I don't know. I mean, the thing is, because of the trajectory of it, he started so high. I mean, at the
well, that's what I mean by it makes sense. Right?
Yeah, because at the beginning of June, it was already 88% of Democrats. I mean, we talked about this a lot on the podcast. The beginning of June, Democrats were like, yeah, this is our guy. We're voting for him. No problem. You know, in June of 2018, 73% of Democrats said that they were going to vote for Beto O'Rourke. So 88% for Tallarico at the same point in time in his cycle. And look, Beto O'Rourke, you know, had a meteoric rise of his own, but you know, you can't say that Tallarico.
People loved him. They still call him by his first name.
Yeah, I've got it here in the notes, Beto. But just for fun, it's easier to fit, actually. I have a lot of numbers on here. But the thing is that, you know, Tallarico had that big moment.
Are you afraid you'll say zero Rourke?
Yeah, it's Rourke. it's Rourke. But you know, the thing is, Tallarico had that moment with, you know, 10 plus million views on YouTube, right? I mean, he's on Joe Rogan. And the thing is, he's, in some ways, I'll be honest, like, again, having watched this multiple times now, he's made a greater effort because of the extent of coverage that he was able to generate through earned media and various appearances. He's been able to spend more time in more disparate parts of the state than O'Rourke was able to during his 2018 campaign. Because we looked into this at that point and said, like, hey, where's O'Rourke spending his time? And he wasn't going down to the border, you know, which, you know.
He spent a lot of time doing the 254 counties.
He did the 254 counties.
Some counties.
But if you look at a lot of the events and where he was spending his time, a lot of it was, I mean, that was after.
Resulted in counter mobilization.
Well, and also that was in some ways criticism because he lost in the primary all the counties outside of the major urban areas where he spent all of his time. So, like, no, 254, we're getting out there, whatever. But Tallarico, because he's already so well known amongst like Democratic circles in the urban areas, he does have a lot more flexibility to get his name out. And I think you just sort of see that, whether it's one or the other or both. Now, for Paxton,
he had 91 in the New York Times, Siena, 89% of Republicans in the Fox News poll, 85 in the Texas Southern poll. I mean, I think to your point, the bigger story is the unusually high numbers for Tallarico as opposed to unusually low numbers for Paxton. The problem that Paxton has, though, is that, or at least in terms of the coverage of it, is that there is a readily available narrative for why his numbers are lower than Tallarico's that doesn't hinge on Tallarico's strength, but hinges on
perceptions of
the primary and the perceptions of the fallout of the Cornyn-Paxton race.
Right. People are looking for him to be lower. But they're making the wrong comparison is what I would say. Because when we look back at all the old polling, we would say he's actually doing pretty well among Republicans historically.
And we were arguing at the time that it was time for people to just accept the fact that Paxton is much more representative of a lot of the most vocal and the most energized segment of the Republican electorate than Cornyn was is or was. So
now maybe surprising in the data, I guess, is that the problem we've talked about, the problems for Paxton and the problem for Democrats in some ways is really Hispanics, to my mind. When I look at this data, Tallarico has been leading in all of the polling, the recent polling that we're referring to here, amongst Hispanics by a margin of between, in the last two polls, it was plus 18 and plus 19 in Fox and TSU respectively. And that seems to be a fair reason to kind of assess where it's at right now.
Right.
That's a 59-41 split for Fox News. It's a 57-38 for TSU. You guys are pretty close. That's comparable, right? And so those are, good numbers for the candidate. But when we look at the 2018 race, when we look in October at the end of that race, Beto was plus 27 among Hispanics, 60-33. And I think, that's one of the, now I will say in the 2024 race, Cruz ended up plus 2. That was, Donald Trump, all that stuff, right? So there is that sort of, and I would say, this is a question, I guess, and I'll just throw this out here and you can kind of come back at me, which is like, so what's the relevant comparison point here? I'm having trouble actually dealing with it now. I think reporters are having trouble dealing with this too. Should we compare this to 2024? Is that relevant? Or what? Well, again, I guess it depends on what you're asking, right?
No, I think that's right. My answer to that would be neither one of those elections is the perfect comparison point.
Yeah.
And it does have to do with, the fact that the experiences reflected in these numbers and how those events unfolded and how those elections took place, make the comparisons more difficult because they're changing the base. There isn't a baseline,
right?
Because the political environment is different enough, and we can't really, I think the better baseline, and we don't have a Senate race for that, would be 2022 and the governor's race, and we'll come around to that.
Yeah.
To give a sense of what we ought to be, what the range of expectation, but I don't think 2024, I think people are using 2024, and this is, again, we're beating a dead horse here.
Yeah.
People are using 2024 a little too
facilely
as a baseline.
Well, I think the point I want to make here, and this is, for those of you who are listening, who are, the sophisticated listeners trying to understand this, is like, yes, Tallarico is polling much better right now than Trump or Cruz, than the Democrats were against Trump or Cruz at the end of 2024. It's notable. There's a huge shift. It's meaningful in the electorate. It's very interesting. However, does it mean that that automatically translates into Democratic competitiveness at the top of the ticket, or that that's the primary factor here? And the answer would be, well, based on other past elections in which Democrats have seemed to have pulled better with that group, it might not be enough.
Right. But it helps.
It helps.
Right. Look, I mean, I think to step back as we're going through all these, like, yeah, well, there's this group,
yeah,
and that group.
Yeah, yeah.
What is complex about this, or one of the things that is complex about this, is that the same thing has been complex about this for a long time, and that led us to generally kind of say, you know, looking at this, it's, you can see sign, it, setting 2024 aside when the argument was the opposite.
Yeah.
You can see signs why the Democrats may have some hopes here or there may, but the numbers just don't add up.
Right. Yeah, we did that.
But the problem is it's two or three different things, right? I mean, off the top of my head, and you'll probably add a couple, it's, you know, Democratic enthusiasm for the candidate. Now, mm-hmm. Tallarico, as we were just talking about, doing pretty well with that. Yeah. Independents, leaning more heavily towards Democrats this time. As of now, again, all of this should be caveated by as of now. That looks pretty good, right? Relative, you know, comparative degree of Republican engagement with their candidate. Maybe some ambiguity there, but
probably not a big thing.
But not big, but also probably maybe worth a point or two.
Yeah, I was gonna say, yeah, not maybe. Helpful. Not helpful.
Not helpful. Right, exactly. Not helpful. Right. So those things, you know, that we're all talking, and then, you know, the Hispanic numbers, which, well, very hard to gauge.
Yeah.
Maybe at least comparable to 2018, maybe a little better. Certainly an improvement over 2024 for Democrats.
Right.
No one of those things was going to do it. And just like in past years, in 2018, people go, yeah, but look, Democrats, people would emphasize first, Democrats love Beto. There's going to be mobilization enthusiasm. I say, yeah, but more than Republican enthusiasm.
Yeah.
And look at independents.
Yeah.
Right. This, all of those things are more in favor of the Democratic position than we've seen, you know, in this period of Texas politics.
And I'll just add one more to that, which is that, you know, when we do look in the suburbs, which are the most competitive, you know, electoral sort of geographies of the state, and all the polling we've looked at from 2024 and from 2020 and 2018, Cruz was never trailing. He was up by between 4 and 12 in all of those polls. In the polls that we do have a suburban estimate for, Tallarico was up by 7 in the most recent Fox News poll. He was also up in our poll back in June. So there's at least a couple of estimates that say he's leading in the suburbs. But to you, I mean, I'm putting it another way, sort of like, you know, your point, yeah, is like, if you go through each of those groups that we think of as sort of competitive in the electorate, and the best thing you can say for the Republican candidate, well, the Democrats not leading by as much as Beto was when he did really well among Hispanics and it was a really close race.
Right.
But he's still leading.
And that's the issue here is, I mean, it's kind of a Rubik's Cube of trying to,
well, part,
you know,
of
it's enough dimensions to measure, and there's enough, you know, overlap in some of those dimensions.
Yeah, I think the key here, and just to finish it, you know, probably move on from this, yeah, race, but, you know, the key here is to remember that, you know, independents, as we measure them and as we think about them, make up a small share of the electorate, and they are the most likely to bounce around.
Yes.
Hispanics, you know, while a growing share of the population, have not necessarily increased their share of the electorate at the same, you know, rate. And so—
Certainly not at the same rate in their population growth.
Right. I should say, we didn't talk about it here, but the numbers for Republicans among white voters looks pretty similar. So that's not something that, you know, their overwhelming advantage among the state's white voters remains, you know.
Harry Enten was on CNN the other day. I was telling you, looking at, I can't remember what he was drawing the sample. I think he was using, it was interesting to see CNN in the mm-hmm. little tiny print using Fox and Quinnipiac or whoever they could draw on for the data. You know, he was arguing that Republicans are doing less well in polling with white voters this time. And I have not noticed that. I guess it's worth looking at again.
But yeah.
I kind of raised my eyebrow at that a little bit.
I mean, it depends on what you mean by Republicans and how he's exactly.
No, know. He just said white voters.
No, I mean.
He was talking about Paxton.
Yeah. Okay. And so, you know, I mean, just overall, I mean, it's certain, you know, Hispanics make a large share of the population, but a smaller share of the electorate, although still, you know, a significant share. But that's sort of the issue here. Rural voters, on the other hand, that is a pretty big share of the electorate. That is actually pretty meaningful. And that's actually one that I think, you know, if I was going to say, like, let me put a pin in this because we're going to come back to this. Like, that's one of those where I think we're going to probably keep watching this because,
yes,
you know, ultimately there's going to be a lot of spending that bleeds out into those areas. They're a big bang for your buck in terms of campaigns, right?
Yeah.
They can hit a lot of voters at once. And they have a lot of data. And so we're going to see, you know, how that kind of shapes up over time.
Okay, now, you know, the governor's race, we've kind of laid out the universe, so I think we can do this a little more quickly.
Yeah, for
but
sure.
I would say that one of the things to me that was very noticeable in the Fox News poll. And now that we've got another couple polls, it's normalized a little bit. But that the Abbott-Hinojosa race is, you know, single digits.
Yeah.
Right? So New York Times, Siena had Abbott plus 7. Month later, Fox News has Abbott. And that's what we had had in early June. Fox News has Abbott plus 1. And then Texas State had Abbott back up to Abbott plus 6. But, you know, that's...
And that's a little bit more traditional because, I mean, I'll say those are the two LV polls.
The 6 and 7, yeah.
The 6 and 7 were LV polls and the 1 was an RV poll. So that's possible to be at least part of that.
Right.
But you're right. I mean, you said something a couple weeks ago, and I think, you know, I've been kind of using this too, and it's a reminder, which is, you know, a decade and a half ago or whatever, you'd expect the Republican candidate to have like a 10-point lead.
Right.
And then the environment, local, national is going to...
And maybe it would be high single digits.
Yeah, I mean like 8 to 12
RVs,
or whatever.
Way out from the election.
Right.
And
then the election environment would kind of nudge it one way or the other, you know, more or less.
Natural filtering that goes on between the two constituencies for the parties, the two coalitions.
You know, where we are today, you know, I think expecting that kind of natural advantage to be somewhere in the, you know, 5 to 7, 5 to 8 point,
right.
6 to 8 point range seems pretty reasonable. And that seems to be where Abbott is kind of comfortably sitting right now. You know, that's what this looks like to me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are some notable shifts in the electorate. I mean, you know, overall, this is doing well with Hispanics relative to, you know, how other Democrats have done against the governor so far. You know, she's doing very well with independents. Again, Abbott won independents comfortably. Looking at our October 2022 polling across that entire cycle, Abbott was up between 10 and 31 points.
No, it's okay. No. Well, just that I'm just stopping to correct myself from earlier when I was saying that in the previous cycles in the Senate races that the Republican candidate was polling clearly better. I was actually than the Democratic candidate than the data on the table such that. Actually, the Democratic candidate with Beto O'Rourke was polling slightly better by single digits. I was really thinking about these Abbott numbers in my head. That the Republican candidate in the governor's race was polling much better among independents, which is the case.
Yeah. So Abbott, I mean, in 22, you know, going from June to August, October, he was plus 10 among independents, then plus 18, then plus 31, which is, you know, effective campaigning, right? No, Osa has been ahead in every, you know, recent poll that we've seen. Is the lowest was plus 7, but the highest was, you know, I'm not going to go that far, but it's been about plus 27. So it's been between plus 20, plus 27 in the most recent polls with independents. Big shift. I mean, obviously, that's a 50 point, you know, or so shift. That's notable. You know, her numbers with Hispanics are pretty similar. You know, Abbott, I'll say this. It's interesting looking at these Abbott-Hinojosa numbers because I will say, you know, Abbott still has work to do, right? I mean, if you look at this, you know, he still has the same problems that Tallarico or that Paxson has with Tallarico. They're just much smaller. You know, we look at the suburbs. Abbott finished 2022 plus 11. Hinojosa in the polling that we have where we can look at the suburbs plus 5, right? You know, which for a candidate who hasn't raised much money, you know, let me throw this question to you. I mean, I'm wondering how this is playing out. I'm trying to think about it. I mean, on the one hand, I wonder to what extent Abbott's focus on Tallarico as opposed to actually paying attention to his opponent is giving her a little bit of a vacuum to just sort of fill right now. You know, I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I think that might be true. I mean, I think it's a pretty comprehensible. I mean, you can kind of understand the approach of wanting to run against Tallarico, who's already been softened up by a bunch of negative advertising, theoretically, at least for your base.
Yeah.
And as you're thinking about independence from the campaign, from the perspective of the Abbott campaign, because it's a, you know, you're getting a double benefit.
Yeah.
You're having your cake and eating it too by choosing a negative object, campaigning across that negative object who coheres with the negative brand, aspects of the negative associations of the Democratic Party among Texas non-Democrats.
Yeah.
And you're not acknowledging an opponent that you know still has very low name recognition. And in that Texas Southern poll, I mean, I think Gina Hinojosa is still 50%, you know, under 50% name ID, right? Just under. But about half, I think in that poll, about half of them didn't, in the fave unfaves, didn't have an opinion of her.
Well, see, this is what's interesting though, but this also speaks to the, I mean, I think.
Well, let me answer your question though, because I didn't, that was all preface in a way, but, you know, does that make, does that give Hinojosa a little bit of room to grow? In a way it does, because there's a sense of lower expectations.
Yeah.
You know, but it also has a downside that I kind of got at there, which is, you know, there's still a lot of people that don't know who she is.
You know, this, right. I mean, someone else can do this. I'm just going to say it out loud. I'll do it with my own data eventually when I have time. But I mean, it does make me want to take our data and look at the trial ballot amongst voters who do and don't have opinions of each of the candidates. Because one of the things that's notable to me when you say that, you know, remind me about, because I was looking at the trial ballots, but that the attitudes towards Hinojosa are underdeveloped at this point because she's unknown. But yet, when we ask Democrats, who are you voting for? 93% Hinojosa, 90% of Republicans say they're voting for Abbott. In the Fox News poll, 96% of Democrats said they're voting for Hinojosa, 91% of Republicans said they were voting for Abbott.
So it doesn't matter.
I think
it's not having an impact on those.
Well, I think it speaks to the trial ballots. It speaks to the nationalization piece to this. I mean, it speaks to the overall challenge that Republicans are facing here, which is, you know, which is the fact that, like, ultimately the national environment is challenging. And to some degree, I think, you know, I know that ours, like, we like the trial ballot. We identify the party of the candidate, and if the party of the candidate is actually what's driving this and have nothing to do with the candidate, that's sort of the thing. But I say that's not historically, you know, what we always see. So, I mean, this is in some ways, it's interesting because I think for Hinojosa, you know, the challenge for her was always going to be, you know, I mean, among many, you know, but I mean, just because of Abbott's war chest and skills and data and all the advantages he has. But, you know, one of the challenges she's always going to have, like all Democratic candidates, is like getting her name out there, being known by the electorate, you know, actually being like a viable alternative. And what's interesting about the data at this point is, like, it seems that being a Democrat makes you a viable alternative if people are looking for a viable alternative.
Yeah, looking at the independent numbers as of now. But I guess the upshot of this is where the governor's advantage, you know, just massive resource advantage. So if we get to Labor Day, we're in August now. We get to the end of this month and then Labor Day, and half of the electorate still doesn't know who Gina Hinojosa is. They're not going to be just focusing on Tallarico anymore.
That's right.
Or it's going to be, you know, do you want to vote for the Tallarico Hinojosa communist wing?
Yeah, Tweedledee, Tweedledum, whatever they come up with. Yeah,
they're going to have that. I mean, so that's the flip side, I think, of what you were suggesting. Right now, maybe it gives the Hinojosa campaign a little bit of room to maneuver. If they do not use that room to establish her effectively among the broader electorate, and I don't know that they have the resources to do that, frankly, then the Abbott campaign will swoop in and spend seven to eight figures and just
carpet bomb.
Define her.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
With persuadable voters.
Well, I think that's
and mobilize and help and also help address what is being perceived in Republican circles as an potential enthusiasm mobilization problem among Republicans. And in some ways,
it's like a 3D chess move, though.
No, it is.
Yeah,
but,
right.
But that's what it is, right? And I also think that as I mull it, or not really mulling it, as I react to it.
Yeah.
That's, you know, there's an advantage, you know, you have some real advantage there in the Abbott campaign to having focused on Tallarico, because then you just draw the line.
Yeah.
I mean, we've seen that before, and it's not very difficult to do.
Well, and also there's a little bit of a rope-a-dope to this, which is, you know, he's not trying to bring her in close in the polling, but by allowing it to happen at this point without reacting directly to it, it does allow you during this resource suck period to go and say, hey, these races are real close.
Right.
And that becomes an advantage to everybody who needs to collect money and do all that. But then what comes time to spend, as you point, Abbott can easily spend just an obscene amount of money when he's ready to do it. And the fact that she's not defined in that space makes it that much easier to peg her how he wants.
Well, and backing up, as I look at all this, I mean, I think there was a few days after that Fox News poll came out that my eyebrows were pretty raised by that Abbott plus one number.
Yeah, sure.
And I think if that turns out to be an outlier, then what we were thinking in June is still pretty operative, at least as of whatever the date is today, August.
Yeah.
In that, if you want to look at what the real state of the balance of power between the parties, you probably are looking at the fact that, as we were saying earlier about, I think, the general sort of atmosphere, the Republican advantage, which we would expect to be 8, 9, 10, is maybe more like 5 or 6 right now.
Yeah.
If you're anybody other than Ken Paxton, because Ken Paxton is in a different position in terms of both a well-resourced opponent and his own vulnerabilities.
Liabilities, yeah, sure.
You know, his own liabilities. That's good. But that is still how it feels. And so that then leads me, you know, for us to close in the last few minutes on, so we haven't talked about this stuff in public for a month or so. You know, if you look at why that would be the case, I think you can kind of see it in both the national and the state environment, why there's, you know, moving around and stuff, but it's not, the Republicans have not opened up a wider lead.
Yeah.
But you can also ask why the Democrats have not closed it more. But in the national environment, certainly the national environment has not gotten better for Texas Republicans.
No.
You know, Trump is still controversial, erratic, unpopular among everybody except Republicans, and
really cold,
showing some and showing some attrition outside of MAGA, the MAGA Republicans and their halo, shall we say. What we used to call the soft Tea Party people 15 years ago. In other words, well, I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't identify as the Tea Party, but I don't think they have too much influence.
Right.
Kind of guys, just swap out MAGA now.
Yeah.
Right. The number's probably a little different, but, you know, the conceptually, that's what we're looking at. So, you know, you've got that issue among Republicans, a little bit of softening of support. I wouldn't, you know, that's, I think, is the fair way to say it. The war with Iran is a disaster.
Yeah.
And, you know, somebody wants to write us and say I'm being partisan. You know, there are plenty of Republicans will tell you the same thing, Democrats, independents. Nobody really thinks that whatever we're calling the conflict with Iran is going well, or that the U.S. is achieving any objectives. And I think the strongest argument right now is that it's been a net loss other than the press office of the White House and the Pentagon.
Yeah, and even setting aside the proximate impact on the electorate is negative.
Right. And which leads us to the other thing is that, you know, the attention – everything is still – attention is still focused on the economy.
Yep.
If you look at the MIPs and, you know, the salience measures, however they do it and all these polling, the economy is still front and center. Prices are still front and center. Those anxieties have not been – they've fluctuated in the last few months, just like, you know, a lot of things are fluctuating.
Right.
But it's still – it's unsettled.
But, you know what's funny about that? I mean, it's not funny. It's terrible, actually. I shouldn't say it that way. But, I mean, it's notable about that is it's not as though, like, the – concern, like, you know, we ask in our poll about specific economic concerns, and it's not as though, like, you know, the poll comes along and, like, they just all drop. They shift. Like, all of a sudden, something else, now it's housing. And it's like, well, now it's healthcare. Now it's back to prices.
But it's all within the same family of prices and cost of living factors that people experience.
Yeah, it's just shifting around between
those. On a regular basis. Now, having said all that, so, you know, I would characterize that as this – there's a kind of simmering discontent among GOP candidates about the lack of alignment between policy and messaging coming out of the White House and the needs of congressional, which we read about in the national press, but also state-level candidates. I mean, Donald Trump is doing nothing to help any of these Texas guys on the ballot. Nothing.
No.
Right? Now, to be fair, or not even just be fair, on the other side – to the question of, well, Democrats also haven't been able to close it in the last – month or two, or close the gap. Nationally, obviously, ongoing media attention to these state level and congressional and sub-state level races in which the Democratic Socialists, or more broadly speaking, left-leaning the left candidates on the Democratic Party are really taking the fight to the establishment, and the D.C. Democrats are losing some of these fights and some of these high visibility
fights. They're seeding the field in others.
Yeah. And to be a little bit fair to the Democrats, I mean, the media loves this story, I think, and loves it maybe, I think, to the point of oversimplification and maybe overemphasis, and I'm not saying he doesn't matter, it does, but, you know, when Abdullah Sayed wins the Democratic Senate primary, you know, you just, the major dailies, national dailies and political press just can't get enough of talking about that. Just cannot, you know, I get all those newsletters. They cannot get enough of it.
Yeah. I've like stopped reading them because I'm all just
the, you
like.
Know, the lead stories, you know, one or two or three subplot follow-on stories, et cetera, et cetera. And then there's a version of that in Texas that we didn't quite get to when we talked about the Senate race that is specific to Texas and not so much left-right, but is this ongoing discussion and very and frequent coverage in the Texas political media of a story about black elite, what I will say is black elite support and its relationship to black voter support for Tallarico in the face of pushback by Jasmine Crockett and people that are channeling Jasmine, I would say channeling Jasmine Crockett's discontent. And to be fair, there's circular relationship. I mean, you know, Crockett is tapping into some of that discontent that is there and is a long and legitimate matter of discussion in the Democratic Party about the degree to which candidate, you know, Democratic candidates, pick your white candidates, take black voter support for granted.
Yeah, and right. I will say, I mean, you know, and just to be, you know, to be fair, not just to the Democrat. I mean, look, you know, if you look at the consequences of the redistricting, I mean, it's black representation that, you know, was definitely dinged here in Texas.
So
like, so yeah, so I mean, that's a real concern. So that is of real concern here. But to your point, I mean, you know, it's been notable the extent to which this has been an ongoing story. And I don't want to say I'm not sure why. I mean, I think it's attractive. I know why stories are attractive, so I can see why this is an attractive
story. Well, it's a classic conflict story, and it's one that resonates with
people. But it's one of those things that also, like, reporters. You know, like a lot of these things, this is what I, you know, I like to do. Like, it just doesn't align with the data. But what's interesting, and we've talked about this, and there's a bunch of articles about this, and other people have now started doing some polling just specifically to address this question. They're all kind of finding
We should just take down Texas Southern released a kind of parallel store, a sub-study to the statewide poll that was focused on a sample, I think, 400 or 500 black voters.
Yeah, and in general, the story is that, you know, we're not seeing, you know, a lack of support amongst black rank and file Democratic voters. In fact, their support looks to be as high or higher in most cases than we've seen for previous candidates, even Colin Allred, you know, black statewide candidate. And so really, you know, at a certain point, you have to say, okay, this is such a story about something else, you know. But you know, I mean, you and I have kind of talked about this a lot, and it is interesting because, like, on the one hand, you know, there's two things I want to say. One, support doesn't equal enthusiasm. And, you know, that's an important distinction that I think, you know, can just be acknowledged here, right? I mean, is it likely that those same black voters would be more enthusiastic about supporting Jasmine Crockett? Maybe on average, yes. I didn't measure it, so I'm just going to say it's maybe.
Begrudging support in the context of what is viewed by most black voters as a completely untenable Republican alternative.
Yeah.
You know, is exactly that.
Yeah, and it's
or might be exactly that. I'm not even sure there's even evidence of that per se.
Yeah, I'm just accepting.
You know, I'm just
We're just being, you know, there's a lot of hands being thrown up here, but it is notable, you know, as we study power and politics and all these various, you know, terms you want to use and throw at this plural whatever. You know, you're kind of like, okay, you know, are black elites going to create a problem among black Democratic voters if they keep sort of advancing this idea that black voters have a problem with James Tallarico.
Right.
And I mean, that's an interesting kind of wait and see. And again, we're all talking about margins among margins and all that kind of stuff. But there is an aspect to this, which is like, I understand why everybody's, you know, positioned where they're positioned. I think it all makes sense, you know, to me, whether I'm talking about Jasmine Crockett, Colin Allred, other black elite Democrats who are taking sort of the lead and taking these positions. Like, I get it. And I think it makes sense, but I do wonder, you know, what is the consequence of this? And does it really, I mean, you know,
well, and it's if you're interested in these coalition dynamics at a very nitty gritty level,
which I am,
you know, I mean, as we look at additional opinion, you know, black opinion leader / elite signaling, we're seeing the emergence of signaling from both sides.
Yeah.
Or both, you know, by both sides, I should be more specific, more clearly supportive of Tallarico, more skeptical. And you've got Jasmine, you know, former Congresswoman Jasmine Crockett, you've got Representative Yolanda Jones kind of on the not happy with Tallarico's side.
Yeah.
Add Colin Allred to that, of course.
Sure.
But then on the other side, you know, Sophronia Thompson, pretty important opinion leader, at least among black elites, and mm-hmm. and a lot, you know, probably more black leaders than black voters than one might imagine.
Yeah.
You know, I would never underestimate for the record, saying that publicly. You know, other members of the black kind of political leadership in the state trying to shore up support for Tallarico. And it's, you know, it's an interesting political dynamic, just in stark political analytical terms, and that is something that has unfolded in interesting ways since we last met.
Yeah.
I mean, because we talked about this, I think, if not in the last podcast, the one before that. And that has gotten more complicated and more active. And so I'll be very interested to see what our next poll looks like in terms of if there's any movement among that we can look at that seems clear, which probably there probably won't be among black voters.
Well, that's really what's nice is, I mean, I'll say this, you know, we talked about a lot of polling today, and that's why it's nice that there's so much polling. I mean, in some sense, you know, we're going to look at our data, but we can look at it in the context of everybody else's, and all of a sudden we can start to, I mean, I'll say this, we may not have a perfect point estimate on, you know, the level of black support for Tallarico because of the margins of error, but you know what? If we get like 5 or 6 estimates, we'll have a pretty good sense of if it's going up or down.
Right. Yeah, and that's great. And then, of course, the other thing in the light that's continued percolating since last we all met together is that this issue of data centers and has not gone away. And adding to it in an interesting, sometimes complementary way in terms of its impact in rural areas, the issue of the construction of these 765 transmission lines, the mm-hmm. high voltage transmission lines being strung,
which you've been all over
across a lot of rural Texas, and they're kind of merging in an interesting way, in part because of their rural impact.
Yeah, right.
Even though I was talking to somebody yesterday about the degree to which these overlap, but they're different in interesting ways. The ways in which they don't overlap, I think, are interesting. Subject for another podcast, I think, is this issue unfolds more. But that has not gone away.
Yeah.
And I think one of the interesting things about it is, I mean, there's all these interesting policy issues about it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also interesting in terms of how it has stimulated Governor Abbott.
Yeah.
Right. And seems to have stimulated action by Governor Abbott and triggered follow-on agreement, some degree disagreement. And, you know, the call and response between the governor and both Republicans and to a lesser degree Democrats in the legislature.
Yeah.
And you know, this is just not going away. And, you know, whether it's like a frontline salient issue at the macro state level, I mean, I think the data centers probably will be 765 lines, we'll see.
Yeah.
But that bundle of issues, I still think, is stimulating nerve centers and in other areas that have yet to fire completely, and maybe they won't in the election.
Yeah.
And we talked about this before. You know, we were looking at that, the data, the long-term data this morning on some of our historic polling on
population
Texans' response to population growth and whether they thought it was good or bad for the state. And we were noticing that between 2018 and 2024, the share of rural Texans saying that it was bad for the state increased pretty noticeably.
Yeah. And I think, you know, to link it, I think, you know, what the question then becomes, you know, is this just about data centers, or is there a set of attitudes that is unifying some of this together? I mean, you know, this isn't related because it's actually going the other way, but I think about, you know, like high speed rail is another thing that really activates this notion of, you know, private property rights in these rural areas and the extent to which, you know, even in the advancement of government interests, it's just not, it's no go, right?
Yeah.
And so, that's sort of the 765 line. I mean, whatever. I mean, it depends on how you look at government interests, blah, blah, blah. But the bigger question here is, you know, I think, and we were trying to, I mean, we're working on another poll. And we were trying to wrestle with some of this, right?
Yeah.
I mean, there's something that I think we could not skin, and I'll just sort of, you know, but there is sort of the sense of like, you know, I'm going to use this term. But there's a local control aspect of this that's sort of interesting here, you know, to the extent that like these outside entities, these businesses, these large businesses, these tech businesses can come in and just kind of do what they want, and that there's really no actual way for most local entities to combat
that. Particularly counties.
Yeah, counties in particular, there is not a way for them to do that. You know, it's interesting to sort of see how that is kicking up these, you know, potentially other issues. And it's going to be interesting to see what political entrepreneurs and on which side try to mobilize this. Because when I look at, you know, Abbott's activity, I mean, my read from it, just from a purely kind of political, pragmatic, strategic sense, not from a policy sense, is this is an effort to put a pin in this, to say like, hey, I've got a plan. It's got everything you want to hear. It's going to lower your utility rates. You're going to have more cleaner water. Your tax revenue is going to have jobs. And it's like, look, that's campaign season stuff. And that's something that I think other Republicans who are having a hard time can say, I agree with the governor that we need to make sure that these are good projects that deliver real benefits to the communities. But ultimately, the actual process to get there and the legislation, everything, that's a big, big, sloggy mess that's coming up.
We've talked about this. Yeah. I think we're often talking about this in different ways.
I think we are.
You and I.
Yeah.
But I agree with that. I mean, I think what's interesting about the governor emphasizing the themes that you just mentioned. And you were just kind of, you know, the kind of, I would call it a modified responsible eco-devo kind of approach is kind of the more obvious tactic for them, which makes sense without, you know, in response to the criticism that in some of the early gestures, just seeing, you know, he was getting criticized, like, oh, now he's just changing his mind.
Yeah.
He's just making a U-turn. Now, I never thought that was overblown.
Yeah, I agree.
But it was a shift
from
the direction that they had been pursuing on this. Now, was it a shift that was purely political? It was certainly partly political.
Yeah.
Or was there a rational policy reason to say, hey, this is having some unintended consequences, including pushback from some of our key political constituencies, but also,
Well, look, and I want to be clear here. I mean, like, I can go back a long ways and say, you know, there's nothing wrong with a politician looking at what the electorate is responding to and adjusting their position to reflect the preferences of the electorate. In fact, holy crap, maybe that's good governance.
One person's pandering is another person's responsiveness.
Well, and for me, but I'll say, so one, I have no issue with that at all. I think that's, again, that's a sign of good governance. I think they'd be great if there were more politicians who are more responsive to like reality as opposed to just, whatever they want. But the other side to this is that, you know, in presenting the, you know, quote unquote policy response, it was done in a way so as essentially to say, here's this list of things that we think people, you know, presume are bad about data centers, but in fact, I'm presenting a policy that it almost is the opposite of all of those things that you're worried about. And to me, that's the pandering part of it. Is it's almost like, I mean, if you go back to, you know, we've been talking about this a lot, but like if you go back to the frustration that the Abbott people had with these data center, you know, projects and the fact that they weren't doing the work to sell it, they weren't doing enough community outreach, they weren't making the case.
Well, that was especially prominent in the even more prominent in the legislature.
Well, right. And now Abbott's doing it for them.
Yeah.
I mean, he's saying, these are the projects that we are going to approve. Right. You can thank me and, you know, leadership for that. But also, like, what he's promising is not something that any of these businesses have promised yet. And that's why I'm sort of,
but you're also beginning to see more alignment between that.
Yeah.
You know, some of the big electric associations are saying, yeah, we're all for this.
Well, this is something you brought up, which is smart about this, which is is a good way to clear out the speculators. And this is why I said, you know, even as all this is going on, there's something within the last week's like, yeah, but if Microsoft is going to do it out in West Texas with a big oil company, we got no problem with it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So if you're a serious player who's got the money, who's going to do it, you know, quote unquote, the right way, then we can do it.
Got the money in any number of different, a couple of different dimensions.
Exactly.
But which I think matters here, but.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think that's all out there. And I think there is a. And so, you know, the point I was making was that responsiveness is telling us something about the political environment.
Yeah, that's good.
Right. And, you know, whether you, however you want to characterize that responsiveness, and people can characterize it different ways. And
it can be,
but even the
thing.
Way that we're talking about it, it is opening up a bunch of other related kind of issues that can be connected with plausibly in other voter attitude. And this is where I think we were different. I've been pretty quick to jump to this. You know, there's something going on and I'm still convinced this is right, but I don't have direct evidence of this in terms of, you know, the AI attitudes and the linkage to the data centers.
Yeah.
Right. Which are just too similar for me, or you can tell a pretty plausible story, whether, you know, we can, it loads or whatever. But I think that, I think you're connecting that with the potential for political entrepreneurship is one of the things that is interesting here.
Yeah.
And we are seeing the Tallarico campaign right now trying to do that, because you can tell a plausible policy story that says we're going to build a viable coalition on this issue for policy when the legislature arrives next year, that makes everything work by enlisting the larger corporate entities to pursue this and to cut out these companies that are probably more incentivized and require subsidies more.
Yeah.
Right. Now, if you're a Democratic campaign right now and you see that, how do you tell that story? This is another giveaway for the billionaire big companies that caused this problem to begin with. And that's who the Republicans are in bed with.
Yeah. Pretty easy.
Pretty easy.
And I don't say that from flip way. I mean, if you've listened for like, hey, easy arguments well, are the
best.
Well,
I don't know if you saw Tallarico's 4-point thing. I mean, you know, that's
easy arguments are the best arguments.
Yeah. And so they're, but
in politics,
these issues are remaining front and center became prominent for a set of reasons that had to do with a lot more of these localized kind of responses.
Yeah. Well,
they are now being magnified by, I think, a bunch of other different things.
Yeah.
The politics of this are one of them, but I also think they are resonating because there is a larger kind of anxiety out there.
Yeah, well, and you know what else we see in the MIPs,
or set of concerns even,
among Democrats generally, is this concern about sort of corruption.
Yeah.
And ethics. And so, you know, that argument is going to land, right? And also just stewardship of the state and its resources, concern about, you know, those resources. Yeah. And so that stuff is all out there. And so really this can attach itself to a lot of different things in a way that, you know, Democrats don't usually have that kind of issue.
Yeah. And this is another thing to circle back and connect the one. And this is why the lack of alignment from the Trump White House and national Republicans, or the policymaking apparatus in the White House, which is driving that right now, such as it is, policymaking is probably too big a word. It's just a problem.
Yeah.
For if you're a candidate trying to deal with this kind of stuff,
right?
You know, if you're reading in the paper and they're saying, "Oh no, we're going to make this a more balanced development process. We hear you. We feel the pain of rural people or consumers." And the White House is going, "We got no problems here with ethics,
right?"
And, you know, so what if we're making a bunch, you know, whatever.
We should build more of these, China.
Or, you know, or the things that can get over, or Trump kind of going, "I don't care about affordability," or, you know.
Yeah.
That is just all a problem. It's just a big problem. So, all right, with that, Josh, welcome back.
Nothing to talk about.
I think we're probably back on track, at least for another week. We'll be back next week with another podcast. So thanks to our crew here, as always, giving us excellent support in the audio studio here in the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Texas at Austin. Thanks again to Josh for being here. Most of all, thanks to you all for listening. Data we've talked about and links available at texaspolitics.utexas.edu. Stay hydrated out there if you're in Texas or somewhere else where it's scathingly hot. And we'll be back next week with another Second Reading podcast. The Second Reading podcast is a production of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin.